powerful is more like it, enlightened, turned into to light. But so it begins. And the Shattering Myth program, at the end of the second hour, I asked IQ Hour Sully what was ahead for Europe now that millions of Muslims have migrated from Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and other countries in the Islamic world into Europe, and he said anarchy. What happened today, this evening, in Paris, Kirk?
Well, the reports we're getting on the news, we've been monitoring, they had six attacks. They had two bombs went off at the football stadium.
Suicide bombers, right?
Oh, yes, and they were hollering Allahu Akbar. Happens to be on Friday night, I thought, with the, you know, right after prayers, probably from the imams saying, go get them now, I guess, or whatever they do. And then there's, they just reported that there was 100 bodies where they were holding hostages. The police finally moved in and trying to free them. But as it turns out, in a situation like that, more people seem to die. So,
yeah, it says 100
locations.
And so at least 100 are dead.
And that's
what Drudge is saying.
What they just said, yeah.
At least 100 are dead. Mm-hmm. And if they're screaming Allahu Akbar, what's the motivation?
Well, it's obviously it's in the name of Allah. Yes, Allah is greater, they think.
Yeah. Yeah, Allah wants to be greater. I'll guarantee you that. He wants to be greater than Yahweh. That is the message of Satan. So you think that this will be sufficient to awaken Europeans?
No.
No.
No, I don't agree.
I'm not sure, though, that Europeans run their country any more, their collective countries, any more than Americans run theirs. You know, the Swedes are very up in arms that their country has become known as the rape capital of Europe. And that comes by way of
Islam.
And mostly from Africa.
Mm-hmm. That come over. Race is irrelevant. It's rape is condoned in Islam.
I'm just saying they come out of Morocco is where they come out of is my point there. And
Morocco, Libya, Tunisia.
Yeah, mostly Morocco, and they're just it's just the rape capital of the world now. And the Swedes say anything about it, the government attacks them. The press won't. They downplay it. You know, the Western oligarchs have a lot to do with this, you know. They don't accidentally flood a country with tens of thousands of Islamists by accident. I mean, it's not an accident, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
chaos comes control, you know.
We probably disagree on a number of issues related to how the elitists are conspiring against the masses, but we do not disagree on the fact that the elitists are conspiring against the masses.
Yes.
When you look at how the United States deliberately and knowingly started the Syrian Civil War, and how the documents prove that the United States, long before the first acts of the Arab Spring, knowingly and deliberately, immorally, started the Syrian Civil War, and that the consequence of that is millions of Muslims migrating into Europe, and the consequence of that is what we're witnessing in Paris tonight.
Sure, and Obama actually went over and helped get that Arab Spring started, as I recall.
Correct. Yeah, he inspired it. Yeah, because it wasn't an Arab Spring. It was what Obama wanted, and what he got was an Islamic Reformation. And there could be nothing more disastrous than an Islamic Reformation, because then the religion was reformed on its roots, and its roots are criminal and jihadi, terrorist.
Yeah, that's right.
So that is what we're witnessing, and it isn't solvable. You know, that IQ is holding out a 1% chance today, and this will be my last Shattering Myth interview today. Was the last Shattering Myth interview with IQ ever so late. And that. Because I'm going to have one more Friday on. Next week is my last week on Shattering Medicine. And IQ is on vacation next week. So he was saying there's 1% chance that, he says there's 100% chance that Europe is going to devolve into anarchy. But there's a 1% chance, according to him, that it's going to come out of it resolute against Islam. I don't think that's the case. I think that,
no, that won't
if
happen.
You look at
no.
the at the history of Islam, every place that Islam has a significant presence, there is either a ruthless dictator or there is absolute chaos.
Yeah.
What else is there?
Well, if you can't reason with someone, then it's the only thing you do is you have to control them with guns.
Yeah, with force.
You've got four major cities in England now where the English are outnumbered by the Muslims. And, you know, they set up, you know, if you're drinking a beer, they come up and they, you know, attack you, assault
yeah.
you.
We have cities in America that are, that Muslims are
born in Michigan would be
not
one
Muslims.
Of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they've got one German town that I read about. There was an article that they were bringing in 20,000 Muslims. Now, this is into a town of 110 people.
No, it's 1,000 Muslims. It's 1,000 Muslims into a town.
Is that what it is?
Yeah,
it was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
but the
yeah,
mayor
reported on it.
The mayor. Yeah. Oh, you did. Okay. The mayor came out and said, "Where are we going to put these people?" And they said, "Oh, well, you know, in business offices that are closed, and in this
yeah.
and in that."
Yeah.
Now,
factory.
What does that do to those people that have been in that town for, you know, probably
yeah,
generations?
And by the way, my comment was they don't speak the language, and I was correct. Is that, oh yes, they do. The new language of that town is Arabic, Syriac.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, they're completely opposed to the culture. I said, no, that's not true. The culture of that town is now Muslim.
Yeah.
Well, they're not going to have any place to go to work. It doesn't matter. They don't work.
They don't work.
They're not there for work anyway.
It's all welfare. But my point here is that who's to blame at that point if not the Western oligarchs that are running them in there and doing that to their own people? And when are the
yeah.
people ever going to wake up?
Did Islam under Muhammad ever attack an army?
No. Only civilians.
Okay. So today, as Muslims showed their ugly face in Paris, did these Muslims attack an armed foe with a declaration after a declaration of war?
No, they just attack civilians, honestly.
As suicide bombers, they and as armed militants, they gunned down, murdered, and mutilated defenseless civilians, people who had absolutely nothing to do with anything they cared about.
Why do you think they were allowed in there to begin with?
Because of socialist secular humanism is based entirely on the satanic principle that exercising good judgment is irrelevant, and that anything that is opposed to God is viewed as acceptable. And that's the nature of socialist secular humanism and political correctness. Anything that is opposed to Yahweh is considered acceptable. There is no religion ever conceived by humankind more opposed to Yahweh than Islam. In Islam, Allah is absolutely, unequivocally, totally Satan. He is the adversary. And so, you know, in Christianity, he is Satan under the counterfeit of the Lord, but not in Islam. In Islam, Allah is Satan. And so they embrace Islam, because Islam is opposed to that which they hate the most. Socialist secular humanism and political correctness exists out of a hatred of Yahweh.
But I see them merging the two religions as an example. The Pope went into a mosque and turned towards Mecca and prayed towards Mecca.
Yeah, you're one religion shy.
Socialist
secular humanism, Islam, and Christianity are all being united.
Oh, I see. That's your trinity.
Yeah, that's the trinity. You were just one religion shy. Yeah, the Torahless one is going to embrace all three. It's just like Pauline Christianity. Pauline Christianity was a blend of Greek Gnosticism, Roman Mithraism, and his blend of Dionysus. So he had, you know, a little bit of, in fact, a lot of Dionysus, a lot of philosophical Gnosticism, and a lot of just political and religious Rome. You know, in fact, you could call it political Rome, philosophical Gnosticism, and religious Dionysian.
The word in Greek used was Sophia. Sophia.
Yeah.
So he was a Sophist.
Human philosophy. Human philosophy.
Yeah, he was just out
so
there
it's
running.
It's not uncommon for these things to merge, and they will all merge. And I know this program is not devoted to the news, but it isn't every day that you have an incident where 100 people are murdered in light of what we talked about today, which was anarchy will soon have a long and dark shadow over the country geography of Europe and the United States.
Well, you know, France has been having the riots ongoing, really, for a couple years over there. I mean, pretty massive riots.
Yep.
Or entire parts of the cities can't be gotten into, you know, by the cops.
You know, today on Chattering Mess, in the first hour, Kirk, while having a discussion with you, was one of those times. There was a lot of times where I just realized, you know, I have I've missed it. I mean, I have spoken of 1% and missed the 99%. And today was one of those times. We're talking about Islam now, which is the ultimate in darkness and death. But Yahweh said, Torah or. And I translated it as the Torah is a light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not what it says. Torah is light. And that's an infinitely more profound and powerful than Torah. The Torah is a light.
Mm-hmm.
So what we discovered is that if Yahweh says I am light,
mm-hmm.
and he says the Torah is light, then the Torah is mm-hmm. Yahweh.
Yeah. Well,
and what
Yahushua is about too, you know.
Yeah, and when Yahweh Kanan says that the light became manifest, and he said the Word became flesh, he's saying that the light and Yahusha and the Torah are all synonymous. But it goes beyond that. If you want to know, earlier it said Torah, and then of your mother, the Torah of your mother. But if the Torah is light, and the set-apart spirit is light, then the Torah and the set-apart spirit are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the set-apart spirit's garment of light is the Torah. We're literally wrapped in the Torah. The reason
that's not much of a stretch there. Yeah,
is
sure.
that we're wrapped in the Torah.
Yeah.
And you come to realize if the Torah is light, then the Torah is the means for us being transformed from mortal to energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that you realize that if the Torah is light, the Torah can have no end.
Correct.
Light. Light is not confined to time, and light can never be destroyed. Light always exists.
Yeah, by being immersed in the Torah, you're being immersed in the Ruach Kodesh. It's simple
Correct.
As that.
Correct.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. But I was unaware of that direct equality, that Torah equals light, Yahweh equals light, Yahweh equals Torah. Set-apart spirit is the feminine manifestation of Yahweh's light. Torah of your spiritual mother means that the Torah and the Ruach Kodesh are one and the same. The reason the Ruach Kodesh enlightens us regarding the Torah, she is the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Well, further, I'm thinking, you know, we said a lot of times, and you said a lot of times, that the synonymous yours Yahweh is synonymous with the Torah and the Word.
Uh-huh.
What you added now is light in the equation, which is
obviously
true.
Yeah, because I never, but I knew that Yahweh equated Torah to light. I knew that did that. I've translated too many passages where Yahweh equates Torah to light.
Uh-huh.
But I've never taken the stark reality that the moment God says the Torah is light, what that means. It means that the Torah and the set-apart spirit are the same thing. It means the Torah can never have an end. It means that the Torah is, in essence, is the garment of light that the set-apart spirit walks us into, or wraps us in, adorns us in. It also means when Yahweh says, come into the feminine manifestation of my light.
Mm-hmm.
You know if Torah, any of you guys know if Torah is a masculine or a feminine?
Feminine.
Because it is an age. You know?
That is correct. Absolutely feminine. Mm-hmm. You want to walk into the feminine manifestation of Yahweh.
It didn't
even dawn on me until this very moment that that's what Yahweh was telling us to approach on his Moed Mikre. The feminine manifestation of his light is the Torah. He defined it as such. Now that's profound.
It is.
Well, you know, he's also the Word, and then if it's correct that he's in seven dimensions, and the seventh dimension becomes communication, it makes it even more. To me, that's another dot to collect or dot to. Connect.
Yeah, another dot to connect is that in every religion I know of, women have to take a back seat. You know.
Here he's everything that's massively profound and important is feminine. But I mean, this from my perspective requires a rewrite of Yada Yah. Because in Yada Yah, I make a big deal, and I think that this was a big deal. That this realization that what Yahweh is inviting us to do, and I don't think anybody else on this planet came to this realization other than our group here, that what he's inviting us to do and asking us to do is to answer the invitation and come into the presence of the feminine manifestation of his light. Now, I think that was profound. And I know that...
That was profound, and you wrote that.
But I missed what he meant. What he meant.
You're saying you're missed. Wrap yourself in the Torah.
Right.
Is that,
I missed what coming into the feminine manifestation of the light is. Come into the Torah. Approach the Torah. Because the Torah is feminine, and he said the Torah is light. Therefore, the Torah is the feminine manifestation of his light.
Well, Dode said he came to have a relationship with the Torah, and he loved it.
Correct. Right.
I mean, that's what he said.
If you're just dealing with straight logic, Torah is feminine. Torah, Yahweh says, is light. Yahweh asks us on four of the seven Mikre to come into the presence, draw near and come into the presence of the feminine manifestation of his light. Torah feminine, Torah equals light. What is the feminine manifestation of his light? The Torah.
Be the Torah. All the answers are Torah. It's pretty
powerful.
Easy for me to answer your questions over here, let me tell you. Yeah, that's always the answer. It's always the answer. You know, it really finally got through to me about a year ago. But on a scale
of profound, my friends, because it involves the Mikre, because it's the answer to every important question, this is 100 on a 1 to 10 scale in terms of our understanding of what Yahweh is asking of us.
Malal is word, right? M-L-H. And, of course, that's with the A at the end of it. And it's also the M in front of it, so it's feminine.
Correct.
And the word is the Torah, and it's name. So, gosh, it's all over the place.
Horeth, the word for covenant. Do you know if it's masculine or feminine?
It's feminine.
Feminine. Hmm. Yeah. Virtually, Imrah, which is the word for the promise that is contained in Yahweh's word. Feminine.
Yeah,
Everything that's important is feminine.
Well, there's the nurturing side, and there it is. I mean, it.
We are babes compared to what we're going to be. And when you're a child in a family,
you need a mother.
Mother is vastly more important to you. Vastly. You know, I have a new granddaughter. And I can see my granddaughter's interaction with my son and with my daughter-in-law, her mom. And it's night and day. I mean, she clearly smiles and loves her dad. And she would much rather be in her dad's arms than my arms or my wife's arms. But she is it's an entirely different experience when you see her with her mother. We're children. We need our mom. Now, the thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to begin with the seven things that God hates and the six things that God hates and the seven that are the abominations. And because of what happened today, well, we know that that God is absolutely speaking of Paul and therefore Christianity, and he's extraordinarily informative when it comes to Christianity, because there is no religion in all of human history that is condemned as many souls. It's the ultimate plague of death. But he is not silent on Islam, and God is never limited. We ought not ever think that he is only speaking of one thing. For example, when he was speaking of King Saul and telling the people, don't do this, this is not in your interest, this is all the reasons you do not want a human government over you.
Mm-hmm.
He absolutely was talking about Saul and the kings that would follow as point two. But he was also predicting Shaul, Paul, the founder of Christianity. I think that in these seven things, I think we can also see Islam, and I'd like to go through them again. Because
can I bring something up real quick here?
Absolutely.
Just before you start, you know, Yahweh, as you know, in the Masal, he talks about the four players spelled out. He spells them right out. Nishar, the way of the eagle, bird of prey, vulture. Call it a vulture. Call it an eagle because that's really their sign. In the sky, the way of the serpent upon the rock. And we know they claim the rock gives them the authority, these snakes over in the Vatican. He says the way of the Navy in the midst of the sea. He's talking about the U.S. That's the biggest
threat.
Nothing comes close to that. And the way of a fighting man with a virgin. So these are the players in the end. None of them are excluded. The big bankers robbing everybody, the clandestine conspirators, the Canaanites, that's what they would be.
Right.
The serpent on the rock, the Vatican, the U.S. Navy, and Islam. Those are your four players in the end. There's no way around it.
Right.
He paints the picture for us. It's pretty obvious.
Exactly.
So there it is.
It is.
I just wanted to throw that out there
because
you know he wrote it. He meant it. He described them.
Listen, Islam did not grow out of Imperial Rome. The United States grew out of Imperial Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Europe grew out of Imperial Rome. Christianity grew out of Imperial Rome. Those three things absolutely grew out of Imperial Rome. And there is no question whatsoever that God despises what grew out of Imperial Rome more than any other human institution. And so you can point to the United States, Europe, and to Christianity as the things that he hates the most. Now, that is not to say that he doesn't hate Islam. He has a lot to say about Islam. In fact, all of the comments that he makes about what's going to happen in the Magog War, he constantly says that it is those who surrender and submit that are going to flood into Israel. Surrender and submit is Islam. That's what Islam means. And he uses the name Allah throughout the world.
And to be fair, if we want to know who created Islam, here's what it says in Yasha Yahu, and I believe it because it says it.
Yep.
On a mountain high, you have arrogantly put in place and fashioned, raised up, and advocated your own bed and death fire. And indeed, you have quickly become a witness for lifting up Allah, the perverse and unrighteous one. killing the living in an act of religious worship to gain favor of a religious deity. I have also revealed and exposed Allah, the wicked, perverse, unjust, and evil one, and the wide, broad death buyer, which leads to separation and destruction. And that's Yashayah 57:58. So he was talking to the rabbis. So who created Islam? The rabbis did.
Rabbinic Judaism, yeah. I got into the biggest battle of my web existence with the guy that has the Robert Spencer, the Jihad Watch guy, because he, as a Roman Catholic, had a conniption fit over the fact that I held Jews accountable for Islam. I said, if it wasn't for Rabbinic Judaism, Islam would not exist. And the Quran makes it absolutely clear that Rabbinic Jews sold Muhammad Talmud readings that he twisted to create his religion, and then when the Jews demanded that they would expose him if he didn't, and this is what the Quran and Hadith say, that Muhammad sought to kill them. And so the riches that he gained by enslaving them and raping them and robbing them, and the bloodlust that he had in killing them, he did so because they sold him. They did business with the devil. And had they not done that, the Quran would not be credible. There would be absolutely no Abrahamic connection in Islam. Be nothing in Islam that is even remotely credible had the Jews not done that. He had a conniption fit. He says, you know, that's anti-Semitic to blame the Jews for Islam.
And don't you blame the rabbis.
Fact of the matter is, Judaism is responsible for Islam. No Judaism, no Talmud, no Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is just a statement of fact. That's like ignoring the fact that Hitler had a Jewish mother. That's ignoring the fact that Stalin and Lenin were both Jewish. That'd be ignoring the fact that Adam Weishaupt was Jewish. That would be ignoring the fact
Lenin,
that Paul was
Lenin's
Jewish.
Father was a Baptist preacher, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Really?
That's true. I want to go through this list, recognizing that Christianity, Pauline Christianity, is not the only abomination and not the only thing that God hates, because most of this also applies to Islam. Behold, presently these six things Yahweh hates, and seven are an abomination to his soul. Now, speaking of the soul of those who do these things. Haughty eyes, visions of grandeur, a rebellious perspective. Now, in Islam, arrogance is predominant. I mean, Muslims, particularly good Muslims, all mirror their God. It is pure. Allah is nothing but arrogance. Visions of grandeur, the very nature of Satan, the nature of Allah. It is the nature of Muslims. They're all stunningly arrogant. And it's just like Satan. Muslims have nothing to be arrogant about. Everything they touch is destroyed. They're so vicious, and they're so ballsy, and we're gonna get you, we're gonna kill you, and you realize that there's a reason Muslims only attack defenseless civilians. They're incompetent. They're cowards. And yet they're haughty. And so I don't think there's ever been a more arrogant religion, people, than Islam.
Well, it was four planes that when they first founded Israel, they were four Messerschmitts that had been thrown together out of all kinds of spare parts that turned an Egyptian army of 10,000 people around in a matter of minutes. They're not known for great,
They outnumbered the Jews by 1,000 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
They outgunned the Jews by 10,000 to 1.
And forced Messerschmitt.
And yet they lost every battle of every war. They even lost the battle, the tank battle of the Golan Heights, where they had infinitely superior equipment, infinitely more equipment. I mean, the numbers are so staggering. Their superior equipment, their superior numbers, and they had
True story. The benefit
of surprise. They hit the Jews on the day that there is their number one vacation day on Yom Kippur, and yet they got their behind kicked.
Yep.
They have no reason to be arrogant.
That is just a fact. I mean, I hear you hitting all the Muslims, and you know, but I got to tell you, the Iranians I know are not religious and don't like Islam per se, and you know what they act like? It's Gnostics. They're more Christians, is what they are.
Yeah.
And they don't know the Quran. They don't care to know the Quran. You know, they don't care about any of that. They just run around and they be nice to people. I mean, that's what
there are a huge number of Iranian Shiite zealots, but there are particularly those that have fled Iran that don't much like Islam. That is true.
Most of them I know in Iran don't like Islam. They'll tell you, I don't like my religion. I've talked to hundreds of them. I've only seen two of them ever that stuck up for Islam. That's how rare it is.
Visions of grandeur. You know, I was talking to my wife the other day, and we were talking about Jews. And it's really interesting. You can't name a single Muslim that has invented anything that has made a giant leap forward in human understanding or just advanced any aspect of human life. Not one. And yet, they represent 20% of the world population. Jews represent 0.1% of the world population, and they're responsible for about 25% of mankind's most important advancements. So how does 20% come up with nothing? And 0.1% come up with 25%?
Yeah, I don't know, man. You call their embassy and let's do a live.
That was not an accident.
Yeah. So you're talking about having nothing to be boastful of. Islam, a deceptive tongue. Well, there is no more deceptive speech than the Quran. There is no more deceptive speech than what Muhammad had to say. Muslims are in a religion where lying is considered righteous, which lying is considered one of the highest things you can do, one of the best and most important things you can do in Islam is to lie. It is a religion literally based out of a wholesale lie. I mean, Christianity...
It's the ultimate religion, in my opinion.
Yeah. Christianity is based on a corruption. A corruption is not an outright lie. Islam is an outright lie. It's not based on a corruption.
Sure.
It's just based on a bold-faced lie that Satan is God.
Yeah, and I want things, so therefore follow me, and we'll kill people and take things. If that was the deal with Abraham, you have to walk out of Babylon on your own. You can't drag people. Matter of fact, we're not Torah observant if we're trying to drag people out of Babylon with chains and wild horses. But
Abraham, on his way out of Babylon, I want you to kill a bunch of people.
No.
And hands that shed innocent blood. There has never been, in the history of humankind, any religion, any political doctrine, any military establishment, there has never been anything in the history of humankind that has shed as much innocent blood as Islam. Islam only sheds innocent blood.
You don't think the Catholic Church did that during the...
No, not even close. No, the Catholic Church... was Machiavellian in its approach to killing. There's very few places that you can look at the Catholic Church and said they massacred tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. And yet with Islam, they massacred hundreds of millions of people, all innocent civilians. I mean, the fez, the symbol of Islam, the fez hat, that red hat, is red because the streets in northern Africa ran with blood.
Red with blood.
Rivers of blood. And they killed somewhere in the range of 150 million Persians and Indians. Right. There has never been anything in the history of humankind that has shed as much innocent blood as Islam. Not even close. And when I say that Roman Catholicism was Machiavellian, what I mean is that they perfected the most ruthless and agonizing torture techniques.
And they people were afraid of them for that reason.
Right. So they used terror. So that if you stood up against any aspect of Roman Catholicism, you were publicly tortured in such a way that they made a spectacle of you. And so they didn't need to and didn't kill as many people as did Muslims. So I think it's, in fact, I'm positive. There is no doctrine in human history that has shed as much innocent blood as Islam.
Until the
heart which devises and writes troublesome, idolatrous, unjust, false, and evil plans. Now, you can't blame a heart that writes on Muhammad, because he didn't write diddly squat. Mm-hmm. But Islam is based on two sources of writing, Quran and Hadith. And so, Sunnah and Hadith and Quran. The Quran is actually Hadith. But within 100 years of Muhammad's life, using the Hebrew alphabet and mostly Hebrew words, the Quran and Hadith were committed to writing. And there is nothing which is more troublesome, idolatrous, unjust, false, and just downright evil as Islam.
Oh, I make no bones about that. I make no bones about it.
Yeah, I despise socialist secular humanism.
It's in there too. It's idolatrous.
And they last 150 years of over 100 million people. It's a disgusting and false mantra, but it's not in the League of Islam. Not when it comes to being evil. Not when it comes to being false. Not when it comes to being idolatrous in particular.
Well, I don't know. They put their statues up of each other all over the place.
I don't think they kill just for the joy of killing. These people kill for the joy of killing.
They kill for the
money. They kill to get everybody in line. Shoot the first one, everybody else tells the line.
Right down. I mean, the last group of people other than Muslims that celebrated killing were the Germans, the Nazis. The Nazis celebrated killing. There was something about Islam that caused Nazis to celebrate death. And in the case of Islam, there is no difference. And
well,
the
case
of
the Nazis,
in the case of Nazism. Their idea was to make death swift, at least. They wanted to make death as painless and as swift and as surgical as they could possibly make it. In the case of Islam, they want the death to be painful. They want to be right there in the covered in the victim's blood. They want that person to choke out and to choke on their own blood and to feel the agony as they taunt them with shouts of Allahu Akbar. So,
I wanted to throw this in, though, even with Hitler, as big a scumbag as he was, you know, his original thought was just to kick the Jews out of Germany. It was
of course,
the Grand Mufti that talked him into killing them all. I mean,
yeah,
that was,
you know, I want to be like, I want to be bolder than Netanyahu, but still a bit cautious. Given the Nazi mindset, I think that the Nazis, in and of themselves, would have come to the concentration camps and would have murdered millions of Jews. I just think that Nazism is such that
well, that's fair.
Yeah, okay.
That's fair, but
that being true, there is no question the Grand Mufti met with all of the architects of the Final Solution before they came up with the Final Solution, and he met with Hitler months before the Final Solution was the first actual concentration camp to annihilate Jews was established. And so his role with those that formed the Final Solution and his role with Hitler in selling the Final Solution all created the implementation of the Final Solution. And that he made a, he was the most outspoken advocate in the world for killing Jews as opposed to robbing Jews and sending them out of Europe. So I think he deserves maybe half the blame.
Okay, yeah, I was just throwing that out there, you know, because
I give him half the blame. I'd say that that Hitler and his immediate cast of characters deserve half the blame. I'd give it 50-50.
Okay. All right.
Feet which rashly and impetuously run to and fro, darting about to approach that which is evil. Now, this applies both to Christians who act like lemmings running to their own demise, thoughtlessly. But can you imagine any group of people running to evil as rapidly as Muslims do, impetuously without thinking?
No, I can't.
I'm sure they all went to the mosque today before they started this.
Yeah, before they did this. This is it's not a surprise. This took place on a Friday.
On Friday, no, it hit me that way.
Right, right. Yeah, after they left Friday prayers.
Now, how in the world? I want you to think of this. How in the world would anyone with any position of authority that could say, okay, we're going to throw you out of this country, have all these mosques full of these mullahs that advance the idea of kicking the Westerners out of their own countries that they've built and allowing them to stay there? This happens in England all day long, too, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so who in the hell is in charge over there? If this isn't intentional, and I do believe it's intentional, these people are not stupid. They're surrounded by experts. They use algorithms today, and the whole nine yards. They wish to control things. You know, it's astounding to me.
I think this all happens in a vacuum. I don't like
talking
about conspiracy because, we have
it is
Yahweh encouraging us not to do it. But that caveat put aside here just for a second. WikiLeaks has provided irrefutable proof that American leaders purposefully and deliberately deceived for the purpose of doing things which were awesomely counterproductive to America's interests. And since they knew what they were doing was based on a pile of lies, and since they knew what they were doing was going to be counterproductive, then you cannot blame it on stupidity. It's part of a deliberate plan.
Right.
The Syrian war, which is going to be the catalyst, I mean, absolutely unequivocally, will be the start of World War III.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out how America is going to be destroyed. We found out that today. I don't know, Larry, if Kirk, you were aware of this. I know that that IQ was aware of it. Well, Kirk, I don't know if you were aware, but I know IQ was aware of it. We found out how America is going to be destroyed today. Did you happen to see what happened today from Russia?
Terry had read about it, but I had not, and I was stunned.
What's going on in Russia now?
Absolutely stunned.
The Russians had a state secret supposedly leaked by error in the state-controlled media. Showing the error leak, okay.
showing the plans
for a cobalt, nuclear cobalt submarine. It's a torpedo, but it's an independent, it's a drone torpedo.
Okay.
That when detonated, will generate a 500-foot tsunami that will penetrate 1,000 miles inland in the United States. 500 feet, 1,000 miles inland. One of them on the East Coast, one of them on the West Coast, will wipe out 80% of the American population in the tsunami. Cobalt
Do you rent rooms?
Here in Ohio. Has a 5-year half-life. And as a result of that, it is almost infinitely more deadly than plutonium or uranium-235. And it will render all of those areas that the waves take in with the tsunami going 1,000 miles inland on the east and west coast totally and completely uninhabitable. And the Russians showed the plans for these two torpedoes, and they're essentially drone submarines, that we have no means of detecting their silence. We can't detect them. We can't stop them. And two of them are sufficient to destroy 80% of the U.S. population and render 1,000 miles in on both coasts uninhabitable. You know why the Russians had that leak today? Because the United States has been so belligerent, so hostile, so immoral, and they pushed Russia to the point they said, okay, you want to play this game, America? This is how we'll destroy you. Go ahead. Keep on pushing. And there's nothing we could do to stop it.
All right, Randy. Wow. Power, military, wow. Totally defenseless. Wipes us out.
Renders the American military moot. There's nothing we can do in retaliation. There's nothing we can do to prevent it. And then we know what the Russians said? They said, yeah. So sorry that this leaked out. But, you know, don't be surprised. The Americans have them, too. This is how mankind, you know, when we read that a third of the world's surface is rendered uninhabitable, mm-hmm. and a third of the oceans are rendered such that they're no longer able to support life, and a third of the ships are incapacitated, two or three of these would do that, would accomplish all those goals. Two or three of these would accomplish every one of those goals. All that's needed. That's our future, folks.
Well, hopefully it's not our future, because I think that comes around right there at the end. I really do. Because
mm-hmm.
I think the U.S. is forcing
that's a
the peace agreement.
Right. Tribulation artifact. That's part of the...
If you ever wondering, though, when
we,
you know,
and I and Kirk, we are not going to be here.
Yeah. No, I was just going
to
say, if you've ever wondered how you are reported all this, how it could happen.
If you're secular, if you're religious, this is your fate.
Yeah.
Wow. You have no one to blame but yourself. You voted for these morons.
Apathy.
Yep. A maligning...
I can't believe anybody goes out and votes. You know, and I just want to throw this in, and I know we're doing Torah study, but this ties in quite nicely. You know this ignorant, arrogant ass, John Kerry, came out and said, I put the article up on my wall yesterday, that the internet will... needs to fall under the auspices of the UN. Well, isn't that beautiful? You have the American taxpayer pay for it, develop it, you know, through the military, but still, they pay for it.
The military-industrial complex is what created it. But UCLA as a institution, General Electric as a manufacturer, and the U.S. Government Department of Defense created...
And you and I paid for it, and you and I paid for it. And then they say it really needs to fall under the auspices of the UN.
Yeah, but you know, If you had a choice between the UN controlling it or America controlling it, which one of those is worse?
Never thought
I'd
say that.
I just don't see how anybody could realistically, say that you're not a sovereign country. You know right. You need to develop this and then give it to the criminals.
What do you think the odds are that the freest, most open vehicle for communicating information in human history is going to remain a free and open conduit of information?
Zero.
Zero.
Yeah.
So what
sure.
you're telling me is that this is the means by which we will be prohibited from sharing that which
that's
is not
right.
politically correct. You know, they're already going to universities. That's the big push right now, is that they're forcing universities to censor free speech. That at a university computer and interviews for internet system, there's websites you will not be able to visit, and there are things you cannot say, and you will be kicked out of school, disassociated from all academic opportunity, if you write things that they don't agree with, or if you visit sites that they don't support.
Knowing what we know, what do you suppose academic opportunity will buy you over the next 5 years?
Well, you know,
and my
guess
view
is that in the sciences, that we still convey information that's useful. Now, I have two experiences with this in the sciences. I have a son that has a master's in aeronautical engineering, and what he learned is directly applicable to designing jet engines. I have a son that is that now holds patents and has been and is very skilled at synthesizing compounds that will take a targeted anti-cancer poison into the heart of a hypoxic cancer cluster and will kill it. But I will tell you that 90% of what both of my sons use, they did not learn in academia, even though they have one's a PhD and the other has a master's. And the master's happens to be in a subject that a master's is actually superior to a PhD.
My daughter's got a master's in biochem, and she's an international researcher now, and just got her fellowship at what's that outfit that pushes all the vaccines up in Atlanta? CDC.
CDC. Oh, great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Talking about
all in.
An institution that is of humanistic. Okay, so apart from the sciences, there is no education. There's only indoctrination.
Right. Okay.
So the value of an education is the negative consequence of an indoctrination. So I would say that an education is now counterproductive. They don't teach logic. They don't teach rhetoric. They don't teach good judgment. They don't teach any skill that will be useful, and they spend all of their time with indoctrination. So I'd say at this point, education is counterproductive.
I'm with you. I mean, I'm totally with you. I don't understand why these kids are going into college.
Well, there was one thing in college got a lot out of it, because that was the first time I got access to a humongous library. I mean, even though my field is hardly anything, just art and stuff, but I could go back for hundreds of years and study art.
Kirk, that I learned anything in the classroom that was applicable to any aspect of my life. I learned a lot in the fraternity in terms of what to do and what not to do and how to get along and motivate people. But I don't think I learned anything. And I went to the Marshall School of Business at USC. It's one of the finest business schools in the country. I graduated top of my class. I'm not sure I learned anything that's useful.
I imagine that, Your Honor. I'm sure you did. I've always been a good student. I've always graduated right up front in anything I've ever did, any course I've ever taken, any license I've ever gotten. But I can tell you that I just don't see anything that points towards continuing an education, although I got a daughter now that's going into nurse. She's going to be a nurse anesthetist. which is fine. I mean, she's just looking at the money, you know, $120,000 a year as a nurse or better. You know, I really don't see the continuation of an education having much to do with the abundance of life these days. I think there was a time, but that time is long gone. You know?
I will tell you, Larry, that while I'm, you know, traveled the world, been in almost 200 countries, very well read. I've only found one thing that was universally educational and enlightening, and that benefited every aspect of my life, and that's the Torah. And I mean the Torah by the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And second,
I know what you mean. Well,
my IQ is not measurable by human standards. I mean, it's just not measurable. My sons aren't measurable either. They don't calibrate the test to the level of our IQs. That I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I felt dumber than I do in the presence of Yahweh's testimony. He is that infinitely more brilliant than I have the capacity of. I just constantly find myself like Torah equals light saying, oh my goodness, how did I miss that?
Well, you know, you look at all that. First of all, you catch a lot of things the rest of us don't. And thankfully for that, okay? But what I do know for sure is that the Torah can be viewed in many different ways. From Kirk's perspective, and I don't mean this is all Kirk does. Artistically.
No,
exactly. Right. It can be viewed through codes and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It can be viewed through couplings and links.
Yeah, your view, your perspective on the Torah is just no nonsense. You're kind of a guy that has been tweaked, lied to, manipulated, offered all sorts of promises, and connived, and you just say, I finally met something that is just totally and completely straight.
Yeah, that's it.
That's your deal. Just totally.
Yeah, that's my deal.
That's your deal. And my deal is the connections. Like, for example, Torah equals light. Torah is feminine. Come into the feminine manifestation of my light on these Moed Mikra. My thing is, I like making the connections. I like connecting.
Come on into the Torah.
Right. you look at Lisa's Remmers. When she looks at the Torah, she comes at it as walking away from Rabbinic Judaism. It's how different it is from that and how much more wonderful it is than that. And so it's a liberating thing from the enslaving and dark nature of Rabbinic Judaism. So we all have a slightly different perspective on the same document. We all come at it from a slightly different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any one of them that's better than another. As a matter of fact, you could have read any of this as a illiterate person 3,500 years ago, and gotten enough out of it to know who Yahweh is and what he is asking. The fact is that with relativity and understanding of what light is and E equals MC squared, we are in a vastly superior position today than they were then. But doesn't change the fact that it resonated with them.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, it dotes. Dode is a billion times smarter than I am, and I'm telling you, he had a billion times less to work with than we do.
No. This is amazing. But as you pointed out before, Dode also had some help. You know,
yes,
when Dode was young, he misread the Torah. You know, he thought he was going to be the big representative, and you know, for anybody to stand in front of an army and face him down, you're a badass representative. But that's the take that the average person has on Dode. We know now. He was saying, when I was young, I didn't even understand any of this. You know, I was worthless, basically. That's what he said.
Yeah, but, you also have to say that Dode had a different advantage, too. And that is that Yahweh breathed into Dode his inspired word, and Dode wrote it down.
Well,
that means, it's one thing to read Yahweh's word and try to convey it accurately and then make the connection so we can understand it. But we're going from there, which he has made universally known to us, and extrapolating on it and expanding on it and exposing and expounding on it. That's an entirely different.
Yeah, this theory. Is not. Yeah, people that say Doad wasn't a prophet are crazy.
For Doad to write about the crucifixion a thousand years before it was invented, that's an entirely different experience. So we can't.
Well, he even used the words, "Why have you forsaken me?" what was said. So I mean, he was a novice.
He was in a. He was in a different position than we were in. I mean, and the time was different. I mean, Yahweh found the need to convey what, through Doad, these prophetic insights, this guidance. He has provided more than enough guidance for us to analyze today, to know today, to understand today, to respond today. We've got vastly more available to us than we need.
You are one of the most academic. You are the most academic person I ever met, and I don't mean that in terms of schooling. I mean, in terms of the way you deal with things, you know, like extrapolating information and saying, okay, mitzvah can't mean command. Now, I fully understand a mitzvah cannot mean a command, but I only know that because of the work that you did. Okay. Most people, it took me many, many, many years to find the right source, okay? Most people today, you can take all the years and preparation and thought that went into these translations, as an example, and you can lay them in front of people on a silver platter, and they still don't get it and don't want it.
Yeah, I think the thing that makes the covenant family that we're part of unique is that when we are exposed to what Yahweh said, and we think about what Yahweh said, and we make connections so that we understand what Yahweh said, it resonates with us. It resonates. It rings true. It's accepted. It's acted upon. We embrace it. We love it. We celebrate it. That's the difference. Like, for example, when I figured out today how inadequate I had been and conveying that walk into the maternal manifestation of Yahweh's light was simply walk into the presence of the Ruach Kodesh. Rather than feel a sense of, well, okay, idiot, how come you didn't make the connection Torah equals light, Torah is feminine? I didn't feel a sense of woe is me. I felt a sense of, that's goosebumps. That is a profound leap forward in terms of my personal growth and understanding.
No, it is.
I
don't mean to even sound, you know, flippant about it. It's a very strong thing. And in fact, that's what he's telling us. Get in there and read it and recite it. Right? That's what he's telling us. Purposes of understanding.
Like he's saying here, incorporate the Torah into your heart, and he's saying that when he returns, he's going to write his Torah inside of us, right on our hearts. So it's all the same concept, whether it's him writing it in our hearts, then us choosing to incorporate it into our hearts now, or responding to his invitation and coming into the presence of the Torah. All of it is exactly the same thing. It transforms us into light. It's every place you turn, it's reinforcing. So then he said that a maligning spirit who utters sedition, breathing out slanderous and deceptive testimony, which incites the deluded to worship false gods. Now, this is true in Christianity. Clearly it's true in Christianity. The gospel of grace is pagan, idolatrous, false gods. A religion that is fixated on the Lord is a religion that worships false gods. The Christmas and Easter and Sunday worship and church and all that stuff, and even Bible, is all the worship of false god, and you have to be deluded to accept it. I understand that it's absolutely, unequivocally Christianity. But what part of that doesn't apply to Islam?
All of it applies to Islam.
Yeah. And the reason it all applies to Islam, by the way, is because
same source.
It is because the God of Islam and the God of Christianity are the same God. And because Islam and Christianity are the same thing.
Yeah, well, that's what the Pope said.
Both religions.
He said that.
Yeah,
same God.
They are the same. Paul and Muhammad were the same. Christianity and Islam are the same. I mean, are there differences? Sure. But at their heart, they convince the deluded through deceptive testimony to worship false gods. That's
no doubt about
heart.
It. No doubt about it. 100%.
And then, this is the abomination to one's soul, and then one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important, creating controversy
like
and contentious strife between brothers. Now, in this particular case, it is only, this is the one, the abomination, where we are forced to say, okay, this one cannot be Islam. The first statement.
Because they're talking about brothers. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the one who claims to be sent out as a messenger. That first statement, the first half of Shalak. Well, Muhammad claimed to be sent out as a messenger. Paul claimed to be sent out as a messenger. Both of those two embody the first part of Shalak. But only one of them was claimed to do away with something important, because Muhammad stupidly claimed that his Quran confirmed the Torah, even though it contradicted the Torah in every possible way. He's constantly saying it confirmed the Torah, and yet Paul is doing away with the Torah. So now you are. That's why. Maybe that's why there are six in one, because the six apply to both religions, and the one only applies to the deadliest pandemic in human history, only to Pauline Christianity. And maybe that's,
yeah, that's
the
one that killed the most souls.
Right.
Because
this thing is presented as six things God hates, seven are an abomination to his soul. There's one of these things, that only one, that isn't wholly both. And it's the last one. The last one is only Pauline Christianity. The one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important, creating controversy and contentious strife between brothers. Muhammad never created strife between brothers, but Paul did.
That to Rambam as well. You know, I mean,
how did Rambam create strife between brothers? What did Rambam do away with?
Well,
Rambam's,
right.
I mean, his whole commentary was commentaries on the Torah. Now, it's twisted interpretations of the Torah.
An
argument, but Rambam tried to unite Jews, not tear them apart. Paul tried to tear them apart.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay.
You're right. I'm not defending. You know, I'm not defending Rambam. Obviously, I'm not.
No, I know you're not.
but they don't qualify, and neither Rambam nor Akiva claim to be messengers.
Well, you straightened me out there. You're right. Yeah, absolutely.
Only Paul, only Muhammad are the only two that claim to be messengers sent out by God. But only one of those, of the four, two claim to be messengers. And of those two, only one that did away with something important. And only one created contentious strife between brothers.
That's right.
Particularly since he's talking about Israel.
Well, and I know we're going to tell you. We end up going right down to him anyway, because he even calls him, you know, the Lord.
But keep in mind that this was, there is a reason that Yahweh said six things I hate, seven are an abomination to his soul. The six things that he hates are true of socialist secular humanism, Islam, and Christianity, the big three religions. The seventh, the abomination to his soul, singular, his soul.
Roman Catholicism, yeah.
Only Pauline Roman Catholicism. That's correct. Christianity.
Now, if you read that and understood that all of a sudden, God, and you're a preacher, oh, my gosh.
Oh, my goodness. But I don't think, you know,
they won't
faith,
read it.
Religion and belief systems and faith are very, very uncomfortable with reason.
Yeah.
You know, when in fact, yeah, I was going to say this at this moment, but having a rational discourse is not only not the strong suit of religion, it's something that's never takes place in religion. There is never a rational discourse in religion.
Where was it? I called you about a year ago. There was I was watching Jimmy Swaggart, and he said somebody sent me a book about Paul.
Yeah.
And he said I wouldn't even read it. It's probably your book too. He didn't
tell my book.
Tell me what it was.
Yeah.
But he said, I wouldn't even open it.
I think there's only two or three ever written. One was written by a person that really went over the edge and went from being realizing Paul was a false prophet to embracing all manner of like almost Kabbalistic spiritualism, mm-hmm. and it really went over the deep edge. Somebody sent it to me, and I you know, read like the first chapter or so, and I went, "Whoa, yikes!"
Yeah, you know, when they're
out, I wrote the author. I said, "You know, you started off right, but wow, did you fall off the planet?" And the other, of course, is the it's not really in the form of a book, but the website Jesus Words Only, and they get as much right as they get wrong. They have a lot that's right there, but they get and now they're doing a lot of plagiarism. It drives William crazy because he goes to the site and
yeah, I know. That's made him mad. Then they misquote you too.
But by the way, I've got nothing. I have nothing against the Jesus Words Only site. There's a lot of stuff there on that site that happens to be very, very good. But I think those are the only three. I'm not aware of any other book that attempts to, not attempts, because Questioning Paul does not attempt to expose and condemn Pauline Christianity. It annihilates it. All right. So then Yahweh says, my son, closely observe, attentively focus on the directions and terms of the binding contract, the prescriptions and conditions of the covenant, the instructions from a father to his children regarding the family, mitzvah, of your father. So this is the covenant of your father, and do not actually forego or reject the Torah, which is the teaching and guidance of your mother. And this is, by the way, this is Torah M. It's not Torah Asher M, which is. It's not Torah Ha M, which is the mother, you know, a definite article. It's just Torah M. Torah equals mother. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Torah equals mother. It's also, here, the mitzvah, Ab. Now, mitzvah Ab, covenant equals father.
Yeah.
Okay?
All
so, terms and conditions
life.
Of the covenant equals father. Torah equals mother. That's profound.
Mm-hmm.
Father's covenant, it was Yahweh that reached out to Abraham. It was Yahweh that provided all the terms and conditions of the covenant. The teaching that nurtures us regarding the covenant is the set apart spirit. So, Torah equals spiritual mother, Ruach Kodesh. Covenant equals father.
That's strong.
That's strong.
Yeah,
choose to fasten them upon your heart, continually electing of your own free will, to place this as an adornment around your neck, because the neck is the place where you breathe. It's where the place where you emanate air, and it over your vocal cords becomes speech. So it is the place where you excel your nefesh, your breath, and it's the place where you either ingest that which is nourishing or poison, or you can vomit up religious diatribes. So choose to fasten them around your heart. So put the Torah, choose of your own volition, to incorporate the Torah with your heart, with your inner nature, and elect to place the Torah in your covenant as an adornment around your neck so that it shapes every breath you take, every morsel you consume, every word you speak. In your walking, she will continuously lead and guide you.
And again, we're talking about the Torah, and we're talking about she. And so we're talking, again, about the Ruach and Torah being one. You know?
Right. And mitzvah is she. Covenant is she. Mitzvah is she. Mother is she. Torah is she. All she. So it's the Torah, the set-apart spirit, the terms and conditions of the covenant itself will guide your walk, your conduct through life. It will guide you on the path to through Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. It's the walk away from human oppression to total liberation and freedom with Yahweh. The walk from man's institutions to living and camping out with God. That is the walk that she will guide you on.
You know, for those of us that really look at the words,
mm-hmm.
you know, really look at them,
mm-hmm.
and really do make the connections, and really do care to know, okay,
mm-hmm.
we're automatically kind of separated from the world. Really.
Yeah.
There's no way to buy into any of it after this. I mean, mm-hmm. you just can't. It's like walking in the fire.
Yeah. Right. You change perspective. You can't look at anything the same way.
No,
you can't.
No, and could you? Yeah, sure. Would you know?
No, you wouldn't. You would just say that's stupid. You know that's wrong.
After a certain amount of understanding, you won't stick your hand in a fire,
right?
Either.
Correct. Because you know what the consequence is. So in your walking, she will constantly lead you, accompanying you when you rest. So now she's describing what is the role of the Torah on the Shabbat, the day of rest. Is to accompany you, to be in association with you. It's the Torah watches over you as you shamar, observe it. It's shamar, al-ata. So on the Shabbat, if you, it's quid pro quo, observe the Torah, the Torah's light will watch over you.
And what could be more resting than knowing what the Torah says?
You. Yeah. Protects you. And when you awake, she will communicate with you, enabling you to seriously consider the situation and the instructions. This is an adult conversation, folks. This is mm-hmm. brilliance. This is, you know, one of the things that kept on resonating today as I was thinking about what are we going to talk about tonight is that what we have come to learn about Yahweh, come to know and understand about Yahweh, is extraordinarily extreme in the sense of there are probably 1,000 people out of 7 billion that have come to understand these things. It's that rare and that unique and that uncommon and that far from the normal the normal belief in God and what he's offering and how to engage with him. We are at literally the maximum extreme from the norm.
Yeah, and by the way, you're right. You can't say understanding because everybody that's left back there holding those religious books and running to their Strongs and not looking at Yahweh's words correctly, those people have no understanding. There's no chance for them.
When several years ago, I came to, 15 years ago, I came to realize that Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuah, followed by Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah, was the path that we walked to God, and that Yosha had fulfilled the first four and would fulfill the next three, and this is the path that we walked to paradise. And about 10 years ago, I came to realize that Sukkah was Eden, that we're walking right back into Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was only about 4 or 5 years ago that I came to realize that the terms and conditions of the covenant require us to walk away from religion and politics, and that they require us to have an entirely different mindset, and that there are 5 things that we need to know, understand, accept, and act upon to be part of the covenant. Didn't realize that until 5 years ago. And that the 5 benefits of the covenant are all delivered through the first 4 mikrei, which is the reason those first 4 mikrei were fulfilled. Now, this is so...
I remember you bringing that up, and I remember saying, of course, why did I miss that? But of
I'm not taking credit for any of this because, of course, it was always there. It's just that over this period of time, we've come to realize things that are not only extraordinarily profound and extraordinarily important and awesomely affirmed by Yahweh, but there aren't even 1/10 or 1/100 of 1% of the world who knows it, or even when presented with this as fact, will accept it. And so,
well, even
you stumble
that, that's
you
why
Hoshea
said, where's
like
your sting of death now? Where's your sting of death now, O Sheol? You don't have one anymore.
Right. So when you stumble upon a proverb like this, which came to us because one of our very favorite people, William the Elevator Man, sent it to me and wanted to know, could you translate this and help me understand it? In my own search, I'm looking for some answers. He sent it to you, Larry, and you sent it to me, or both of you collectively sent it to me.
I said, okay.
You know, that's interesting. I'm going to look at that. And here what we find in this proverb, in every word from beginning to end, is an absolute confirmation of what we have come to know and understand and what we've accepted. Now,
well, but you know what?
That's
what
I want this program to be, is, okay, we are out on an extraordinary limb, but this proverb affirms that what we have come to know and understand is absolutely consistent with what Yahweh was saying. We are right.
Yeah, and from start to finish, once you have accurate translations, and that's so important, not only because the Torah is the Ruach, but also because if you have accurate translations, you have Yahweh's nature, and when you look, it doesn't matter whose pen is in hand. It doesn't matter if it's Dodes. It doesn't matter if it's Zachariah's. It doesn't matter, you know, if it's Malachi's. It doesn't matter. They read the same. They always read the same. And they never contradict each other, which is nothing you can find in a Bible. Man, it's full of contradictions.
What I wanted the message for tonight's program to be is that while what we have come to know and understand about Yahweh is extraordinarily unpopular, that every time we examine anything that God has to say, the guidance and direction is always consistent, affirming that what we have come to know about Yahweh is
100%
accurate, and reliable.
Now, let me say one little quick thing. I translated it as best I could. I didn't know it was going to be so much in focus. You did a tremendous job. And I was delighted to know at least the bones were correct. But since we've been working on it this week, and as much time as I had, I tried to look up every ancient word and every letter. And I got about 70% of that done. And it's unbelievable, the shading on the words and on the letters.
Yes.
I mean, this is not wrong. You can't argue with this stuff.
No. In fact, you got it
right on
the words. When you're dealing with
I can at least say to the world out there that's listening, you know, I totally do it yourself. And if you can come over some, I'd love to hear it.
Two of my favorites, we talked about them on Shattering Myths. One was Ben on the positive side. Ben is the family home and the child born with an inheritance. It's home and sperm. So family home for a child with an inheritance is the Hebrew word Ben for child. And then you look at Ra, which is the Hebrew word for evil, for troublesome, for counterproductive, for false, for fraudulent. And Ra, and it's not only Amun Ra. It's the same name as the Egyptian sun god, the principal god of Egypt is Ra. It's Ramses, as in Ra, the son of Ra. That Ra is human perspective, human understanding. The head and the eye is Ra. This is the human way, the human perspective, human understanding is what God has defined this word as evil and fraudulent. You know, so you just take those two, and you go, okay, what an affirmation that the pictures paint the picture. I mean, the letters paint the picture.
Yeah. See, you guys are a lot better at that than me. I don't get as much out of the pictures as you guys do. I really don't.
Well, it's just my thing, that's all.
Yeah.
No, you're good at it.
It's a marvelous affirmation. It's just one more affirmation.
When you know what the word means, and then you look at the picture, you go, okay, that's human understanding.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
Then,
yeah.
You know.
But you know, understand too that Kirk made this very clear the other day.
Yeah.
And I'm in the same boat here. I'm just not as deeply in the boat as Kirk is. I never look at what the letters say first. I always go to the lexicons, and I'll always go to a minimum of 4 or 5 lexicons for every word. Even the words that I know, that I know inside and out and in between, I still always look them up in the lexicons. And I
are you doing that online, or are you doing it with a say a Jeffersonian carousel there? Where
no, I used to do it with a Jeffersonian carousel. Then I did it with the Jeffersonian carousel with all hardback books and online. And now I do it 90% because of I bought the latest upgrade and then the latest version of Logos. Man, I've got many thousands of dollars in my Logos software. And then I look it up in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which I use as an actual physical book. But the rest of it, when I'm using Logos, I have 2 interlinears open all the time. And I have on my Logos not only 2 interlinears open all the time, I have 20 different lexicons. So I'm using 20 different lexicons, and I've got 2 interlinears open all the time.
What interlinears are you using there?
I bounce between them. It's one of those things I hate to even recommend because they all have their pluses and minuses. But then the thing that I always do now is I never, ever consider translating a word unless I look at every variation of the word with every diacritical mark so I know of every variation in the pronunciation of the word to see. Like, I had never taken the time to, I'd just gone to Ra, and Ra means evil. I had never looked at everything, or Arab. I had never taken the time to look at every root and every similar word described with the same letters as to analyze what everything that Arab could mean. I had no idea. And so, you know, if you don't look up the words, if you just, okay, I know what Arab means, and you just say, I'm just going to write down the meaning because I've dealt with this word 500 times in the past.
As in sunset, as in darkness.
Yeah. And what you find is you always have the opportunity to learn. And that, for example, when I did the study this time on Arab, and I found prophetic truth that, Arab means adversary, foe. And there has never been a greater foe of that which God cares about, Yisrael, than Muslims who are Arabs. Now, not all Muslims are Arabs, but Arab and Muslim have been made synonymous by Islam.
Well, it came out of Arabia.
And so there's profound. I mean, if you really care about the words, if you closely examine and carefully consider them, every single time you can learn. That's the point I wanted to make, Kirk, is that, we look at what the letters say about the words, but not after
the fading after the fact.
Yeah, that we've looked at every lexicon, every root, every similar word, the components of the word. Like, for example, Arab is the raw, absolute evil, plus the B. So it's the B means
plus the what?
With the adversary. Mm-hmm. You know, the B is a conjunction with the adversary. And the B also by itself means home and house. So it's the house of the adversary. That's why Muslims buy the world. There's the Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb, the house of war, the house of Islam. And so you look at the word and you say, God told us all of this 3,000 years ago.
You know what's amazing to me? When I look at the very end there, and they're screaming, Allah Akbar, while they're running into the, breaking through the north wall of Jerusalem. I have a tendency to believe that after all these nukes, you know, it's one of the old things where, you know, you don't go to sleep with a dog that has fleas on it because you're going to get up with fleas.
Right.
I think Ha-Satan turns on the Vatican. I think Islam ends up being the in power. Even though they're merging the two together, right? I have a tendency.
Yeah, I guess I don't because of Daniel.
You don't?
Okay. Yeah, because of Daniel. Daniel.
Well, he just says
really
he grows
clear.
Out of that. That's lowly and little, and you're falling
yeah.
Christian. But if your whole thing's about power, it's not like it's about anything other than power.
Yeah. Evil will play the Machiavellian game, the Sun Tzu game. By the way. France has declared a national state of emergency. It closed its borders. More than 120 people have been killed. I'm reading the most recent article on it, and they document where everything took place, that France has declared a national state of emergency, that they've said it's gun and bomb attacks. Guess what they do not mention?
Islam.
They
didn't mention all night. They said they hollered, Allahu Akbar, and they didn't, and not once did they say Islam.
That's what I read in the articles, too. I was stunned.
I was watching the news on the TV.
Yeah.
And they couldn't bring it
to how could you leave that out? That they were screaming Allahu Akbar unless you were purposefully and deliberately trying to deceive?
Right. That's right. But, you said it yourself. Media darlings and political actors. You know, I mean, there it is. It's just pathetic.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. Sure it is. Yeah. I think these elite forgot who enriched them with all their slave labor. You know, guys like us as an example. You know, please.
Wow. When you awake, she will communicate with you, enabling you to seriously consider the situation and instructions. For indeed, the prescriptions and conditions of the covenant are a lamp illuminated by lava, olive oil. The Torah is light. They are the way for rational discourse, the way of lives, for rational discourse about being right. You want to have more than one life? You better have some rational discourse about what's right. For the purpose of closely examining and carefully considering so as to protect you from the woman who is evil, repulsive, and offensive, severing the relationship from the smooth and seductive tongue of the treacherous whore. Remember when Yosha, after he praises Ephesus for having continued to show love for Yohanan, their first love, and having rejected the false apostle who was Paul and his pal Timothy, that he then moves on to three communities, and the first of them is the seat of Satan. The second, he says, married the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And the third, he said, was dead. Well, Jezebel means that you're marrying the whore of Babylon, which is you're marrying Satan. This says that the Torah is what's going to protect you from that whore. That's what this says.
Well, I don't think any of us could be talked into marrying the whore at this point. What do you think, guys?
But that's the nature of Islam. They married the whore. But, we talked about this last program, that the Torah and its covenant are the way of lives. How to conduct this life, how to get the most out of this life, how to transition this life into eternal life. And they're about being right. And nothing is more important when it comes to Yahweh's testimony than being right. Let's get it right.
There's
complete
a lot
and accurate translation. And then correct understanding
and
perspective based on it.
That was beautifully done. People waste their entire lives looking for the path they should be on. And isn't that really what we're taught? Mm-hmm. That we're going to, and this probably goes back to secular humanism more than the other two sickening religions, but, you know, I want to make a difference. And in the end, somebody dedicates their entire life to absolute nothingness. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Isn't that
yeah.
what goes on?
Sure. Yeah, for the smooth and seductive tongue of the treacherous whore. You know, Moloch, the spiritual envoys, we talked about this, are they're not a sexual being. But there is, Yahweh applies masculine and feminine characteristics to things to drive a point home. And in the case of the covenant, since Yahweh views the covenant as a marriage vow, and he's married to Yisrael, the spiritual demons that use slander and slippery tongues to lure others away from God are presented, therefore, as feminine, as adulterers, as whores.
Mm-hmm.
That's the concept here. And it's also the concept of, if Torah equals set-apart spirit, then anti-Torah equals the whore,
mm-hmm.
the prostitute. The whore of Babylon is the anti-Torah.
Yeah, the foreigner, the alien, the one,
yeah.
all those
mm-hmm.
things.
Yeah. Where Yahweh's presentation is wholly credible and will appeal to your reason, the anti-Torah, the whore, is a smooth and seductive, slippery and flattering, treacherous, adulterous.
Well, he always says it in terms he could understand. I mean, every grown-up man understands what he's talking about. I mean, you're the John. They'll say whatever you want to hear.
That's right.
Pay me.
Yeah, you should not genuinely or continually covet or find desirable her beautiful and graceful appearance. Boy, I tell you what, she's got a beautiful appearance in the capital buildings and the religious buildings of mankind in your heart. And do not let her actually obtain control of you on an ongoing basis. Boy, it's lords that control, isn't it? With her flaunting display of flashing light and her flirting eyes. For indeed.
Yeah, and of course, they're just reflecting the false light. We know that.
Correct.
You know, I mean, that's what they're doing.
Correct.
Yeah.
For indeed, the price of the loathed female whore is as much as an everlasting loaf of bread. The bread of life. That's the price you're going to pay to cavort with the whore. But the woman's or man's soul that she is stalking is that she eternally victimizes is valuable. And this is the thing that you mentioned earlier, Larry. Can a man consistently scoop up and carry away fire in his lap or his deceitful garments and not be burned by the serpent? Burned and serpent are the same word here, Seraph. You know, if you scoop up this fire, if you play with religion, you're going to be burned.
It also means to be branded.
Off, should be burned. It also what, Kirk?
Means to be branded. And I was thinking, you know, 666, take the mark.
Yeah, it does mean to be branded. Absolutely. To carry the brand.
But, I mean, these little things
kind
that,
of ownership.
Wherever you go, it just keeps telling you the same expanded story. It's amazing.
Everywhere we go, though, everywhere we go, Kirk, everywhere mm-hmm. we go, Craig, we see this. I mean, everywhere. There is almost not a conversation worth having with most people. Period. You know, they're running around, as you just branded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm telling
right.
you.
The mark. Sign of ownership. And the having scooped up and swallowed the fire.
Can
an individual consistently walk upon the burning coals or the flashing light from the sky and his feet not be scorched? Now, this is a direct ode to religion. This is why context is so important in understanding. today we think about walking on coals, and, you know, there's a few people that do it at carnival shows. But we never, the 99.99% of people would not equate walking on coals to something that was integrated as one of the rituals in the Babylonian religion. It was an essential part of the religious schemes of the day that this was written. So he's saying, or can an individual consistently engage in religion and not scorch his feet? And if your feet are scorched, guess where you can't walk? You can't walk the path that Yahweh has provided. And so what he's saying here is, if you are religious, that's what walking on coals is. That's why Yahweh calls it as an abomination. If you walk on coals, you're not going to be able to walk to me. Your feet are going to be useless to you. You'll be scorched by that religion. So here is why context is important. Therefore, and likewise, the one who goes to his fellow countryman's woman, his that ish, the female individual, he will not be partner seen as innocent, including all who make contact and are plagued by her. Now, this Christian Biblos, Bibles, Babbles, will tell you that this is talking about having sex with your neighbor's wife.
No. It's got nothing to
but
do.
I'm going to tell you, if you have intercourse with your neighbor's wife, you are not going to be plagued by her. And this idea of, since the instruction on adultery says, you know, do not consistently engage in adultery. Don't engage in an adultery on an ongoing basis. This is Bo. It says, the one who goes to his fellow countrymen's female feminine influence, he will not be pardoned or seen as innocent, including all who make contact and are plagued by her. Those are not things that happen as a result of adultery. But those are things
people
that
aren't plagued by her.
You know,
exactly.
But
you know,
religion will plague you. The whore of Babylon will plague you. And you can't be forgiven if you are actively advancing religion. That is what we're talking about here, and it's the only way that you can look at this, because God only says that there's one of the seven things that he says will cause you not to be forgiven. That's unforgivable. Negating the importance of his name and accepting and advancing doctrines which are lifeless is unforgivable. And this is now unforgivable. He will not be pardoned or seen as innocent. Lo naka. He will not be free or blameless. He will not be acquitted or forgiven. And as a result, will not go unpunished. So this is a really serious thing. And if you read the Ten Instructions, God does not say that he who commits adultery one time or even multiple times will not be forgiven. There's a cure for adultery. There is no cure for this. So this ain't adultery, folks. This is flirting with religion. This is embracing religion. This is Jezebelian. This is what happened in Roman Catholicism. This is marrying the Lord. Don't they have contempt for, in this regard, the thief or the kidnapper? Even if to satisfy his soul because he is famished. So, you know, the kidnapper or the thief may say, oh, boy, I was needing this. I hadn't had sex in a month of Sunday, so I had to kidnap this little girl. No one loves me, so I had to kidnap this person. I don't know how to work, so I need to enslave this person. I'm unwilling to work, so I need to steal this food. I was hungry, so I stole the crab legs. And they're saying,
the state.
But don't reasonable people still have contempt for that individual? That's what God is saying.
Yes.
So, in and he's saying it now in conjunction with showing an affinity for going to the whore. And he says, you know, I don't care what your excuses are for going to the whore. That's what he's saying here. There's no justification. You wanted to go along. You wanted to make a living. You wanted to be accepted. So you went along with religion. You know, you did your, put up the Christmas tree because you wanted to go along and get along. God says, no, I'm not buying any excuse. I don't care what your excuse is. I want to show a contempt for it. And if he is discovered, he will repay, making restitution sevenfold for their promises with all of the wealth and possessions of his household. He will forfeit. He will give. He will provide. So God is saying, yep, you choose that. There's a consequence. And by the way, the consequence is that if you rob somebody of their soul because of what you did, and he's talking about souls here, if you rob somebody of their soul, you're going to pay sevenfold. That's the consequence. God does not take this stuff lightly. Then this is the only mention of adultery in all 35 statements. Committing adultery, but it's not not off. Committing adultery by way of religious idolatry and infidelity, most often used to address adultery in the sense of idolatrous worship and religious infidelity. Now, even the lexicons, mm-hmm. I mean, every lexicon said, okay, the word's primary meaning is adultery, but they say, every one of them said, but it's primarily used in the context of saying cheating on or breaching the covenant.
And breaking where they are.
Yeah, so they know that it's not talking about a sex.
Mm-hmm.
This is about cheating on the covenant.
Yeah, to break wedlock, which, I mean, it's a marriage contract. So, I mean, they would have gotten it.
Yeah. With the female individual, the Isha, who is heartless and impoverishing, even life-threatening, corrupting and destroying the soul of he who consistently chooses to act like this. You know, you may get gonorrhea or syphilis or herpes or AIDS if you have sex with a prostitute. But, you know, not a single one of those things can influence your soul. You may be thrown in jail if you're arrested for having sex with a prostitute. You ain't going to jail for it. You aren't going to lose, I mean, you're not going to lose your soul. When Yahweh says that the consequence is your soul, he's not talking about sex. Sex and souls have nothing in common. So he is telling you here that this is religious adultery. This is idolatry. This is breaching the covenant. And breaching the covenant will corrupt and destroy your soul. Now, fortunately, God says it's doing it once, getting involved in religion, or doing it for a period of time. So long as you stop, its influence on your soul stops. But while you're doing it, it is corrupting and destroying your soul. He will discover, devise, and obtain the plague. And insult of the lowly and little one, his contemptuous and taunting slurs and rebuke will not be wiped away. So now he is saying, all right, your soul is plagued by engaging in religion. Your soul is corrupted and it's plagued by engaging in religion. And he says that what you're going to find is that this plague was designed as an insult by the lowly and little one. This plague is his contemptuous, taunting slurs and rebuke. And I'm not going to look the other way, God's saying. I'm not going to blot that slate clean. The lowly and little one is Paul. The lowly and little one is the Roman Catholic Church that grew out of Imperial Rome. And God said it's the plague of here again. It's the insult of the little and lowly one. The slurs and rebuke will not be wiped away. Christianity slurs Yahweh. It rebukes Yahweh's testimony. Rebukes his name. Rebukes his testimony. It is contemptuous. It's shameful. It's insulting. It's slanderous as it relates to Yahweh. And God said, I'm not going to look the other way. I'm not going to forgive them.
Now, that's a Larry note there.
Yeah, and it's all the direct result of the insults that became the Christian New Testament as they were scribed by the one who named himself lowly and little, Paul. Because indeed, envy makes a human being venomous, hostile, and antagonistic, and he will not show or take pity or show mercy in the day of reckoning and payback. You know, I did spend a fair amount of time in the end trying to understand what motivated Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really care much. And initially, all I wanted to know was the truth. I just wanted to find the truth. Was Paul telling the truth? Was Paul lying? And then once I found out that Paul was lying, all I really cared about is awakening people to that and exposing and condemning Paul so as to help people emerge from this horrific plague of death. But so many people wrote me and said, well, what was his motivation? I mean, he admitted he's demon-possessed. What was his motivation? Why would he make these claims? According to God,
he wanted to be somebody.
Envy, yeah.
He was vain.
Yeah, he was vain. He wanted to be considered as more important than the disciples. He wanted to be considered more important than Yahusha. He wanted to be considered as smarter than Yahweh. He wanted to be those rabbis that rejected him. He wanted to be the smartest of the rabbis. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be the smartest of the Romans. He wanted to be the most feared and most respected person in the world. He wanted the world to think that God chose him alone to come up with the plan of salvation for humankind. He was envious of what other people had. Today's world, he'd be as envious of the covenant and of us as a person could possibly be. He was grotesquely insecure. I figured that he was insecure when I was writing, because I just saw every quality of insecurity screaming out of through Paul's words. And insecurity is always driven by envy. So God has said here that it is envy that caused him to be so hostile, to be so antagonistic, to tear Yahweh down, to try to tear Yahweh down. And God is saying, I'm not going to take pity. I'm not going to show any mercy, but you could also read this as lowercase he. Paul is not going to show any mercy. He's merciless in the day of reckoning or payback. He is not willing to accept or endure the presence of any reconciliation, ransom payment, or appeasement. And he is unwilling to yield, and therefore he will refuse to accept you no matter how great or numerous your gifts. Boy, what this is that don't think for a moment that you're going to influence God with your indulgences, with your donations, with your good deeds, with your bribes. He ain't buying it. He doesn't need money. He doesn't want money. Can't be bought. Not going to change no matter if you have established 1,000 universities, 1,000 hospitals. You've fed 1,000 orphans. You've donated $10 billion to charity. It ain't going to matter. He's not willing to accept or endure the presence of appeasement. He can't be appeased. He has a plan. He likes his plan. His plan is right. You can either accept it, reject it, or ignore it. You aren't going to influence him. You're not going to change it.
Well, what an insult to think you could come up with a better plan, a fairer plan. I mean,
yeah, a more beneficial plan.
A more beneficial plan.
Yeah. But all I want to do is I want to have a correct understanding of Yahweh's plan, and I want my response to it to be right.
Mm-hmm.
What else matters?
No, so sorry, all.
Right. I would spend no time trying to demonstrate that Yahweh is offering a good deal, that he's offering, that his plan is well thought through, and that his plan is beneficial. There's no point to it. Is it beneficial? Sure. Is it well thought through? Absolutely.
Is it a plan?
Let's just say that it wasn't well thought through. He's the creator of the universe. He's the author of life.
Go there anyway.
If he's offering a plan, it's the only plan. And he's telling you it's the only plan. You either accept it or reject it. Now, the fact is that his plan resonates, that his plan is awesomely beneficial, that he gets a lot from it and we get even more. But does he need us to sell it? He doesn't even sell it. And I'll find Yahweh spending a lot of time trying to encourage us to accept the covenant, to tell us if we accept the covenant, these are all of the marvelous things that you're going to get. I mean, it's by implication that you get eternal life and that you get perfected and that you get adopted and that you're enriched and empowered, and that you become a energy light-based entity. But I don't think God goes out of his way to extol the benefits of the covenant. Or does he ever try to say, you know, I thought of a lot of different plans and I settled on this one because I thought this was overall best for all parties involved. It's, you know, it is his house. It is his universe.
Well, he took a long time
to decide whether or not his plan's fair or right. I happen to think it's right. I think it's fair. I think it's great. But it matters to me because of who he is. But, you know, we're not in a position to argue with him or debate with him about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's his house. You know, we've talked about this a lot. I think his plan is perfect. I think what he's offering is beyond comprehension beneficial. I can't wait to experience all of it. We can't even imagine how good it is. But he's not trying to lure us into accepting it by way of bribe either.
No, he doesn't have his head in his hand.
No, Yahweh could absolutely come out and say, listen, here's what it's going to be like in eternity. You know, I've got 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars in each of them, and I've conceived life on all of these planets and solar systems, and you're going to be able to go out and not only explore it, but interact with it. And I'm going to go out there with you and explain the thought process that went into it, and then I'm going to let you also engage, and we're going to discuss various things that creatively we can do together. And then I'm going to let you go and explore the very elements that comprise the matter and energy and go to the very formula of creation and witness creation. And then we're going to come together around a campfire once a week and we're going to sing songs and share what we've experienced and what we've learned and what we've created and done. Now, he could go into great detail about all of that. He just doesn't. Mm-hmm. Why is it?
Well, my point to your point was, look how long he took Abraham before he let him know even more and more and more.
Right. Yeah, I just think it's
if he wanted to try to lay it all out the first day, he could have laid it all out the first day. He let him grow.
Are you interested? Yeah, are you interested in coming to know who he is? Mm-hmm. Do you like him?
Mm-hmm.
Do you respect him?
Certainly.
Do you care about what he's offering? Do you want to participate? Do you want to spend eternity with him?
Yeah.
Are these things appeal to you?
Mm-hmm.
Does his testimony resonate? Do you find it enjoyable?
Pleasure, Bill.
If you do, welcome. If you don't, good riddance.
Yeah. And that's fair.
That's fair. You know, we've done 2 hours tonight, and so...
in a hurry.
Yeah, went by in a hurry. This is fun stuff. And I think next week, Kirk, what I'd like to do is talk big picture. Just
okay.
We have 5 days left. Let's just, the whole thing will be big picture.
Alrighty.
Why is it that Pauline Christianity is wrong? Why is it socialist, secular, humanism is wrong? Why can't you depend upon your government? What's the consequence of these things? Where's the world headed? How do you avoid the negative influence? How do you become part of the covenant? What is Yahweh offering? Who is he really? How does he different? How is he different from the religious depiction of him? Just all big picture stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a real quick question pertaining to that. Because my work schedule is still tough for me to do more than 1 hour, so on Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. So is that a big deal? I mean, you're still going to do the news in the first hour? Okay.
You know, I think I'm going to try to do news. I'm going to try to do news, but all I'm going to try to do everything big picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
don't before I go to work.
You know, the deal is, and even this is going to be going forward as we try to do 2 hours of recording that will play 1 hour each day during the week. That we're going to do it when we want to do it. We're never going to go beyond which is easy and fun.
Okay.
Never want it to be a burden. Never want it to be difficult.
No, it's not a burden. I just try to schedule a little bit so I make sure I get up early enough to get everything done. So. But no, it's been a tremendous pleasure. I know where you're going. It's probably going to be better than anything where you've been. But it sure was fun.
Yeah, it sure was fun.
And I want to participate as much as I can. So.
Yeah, and we're going forward. We'll do what we did tonight. If the news is profound, we'll talk about the news.
Okay.
But if it's just an ordinary day, we're going to focus on translation and understanding based upon the translations.
Terrific. I have to call it a night.
Good night.
Great, wonderful. And is Larry gone? He's still there?
I think he is. Yeah,
okay. Well, if not, tell him I say good evening, and I'll see you all later. Yes,
all
sir.
Right. Good night.
Bye.